This is New Home Insights, the John Burns Real Estate Consulting Podcast. I'll be your host, Dean Worley. As the title promises, we're going to bring you insights into everything housing. Latest trends, innovations, observations, and issues of the day. We'll bring in colleagues here at John Burns and also some major industry players from all across the country. This podcast is going to be quick, fun, but also hopefully make you think. So see you here every couple of weeks. Now let's get to it. Welcome to the latest edition of New Home Insights at John Burns Real Estate Consulting. I'm your host, Dean Worley. Today, I have a very, very special guest. It is Dallas Tanner. He's the interim president of Invitation Homes and the chief investment officer there since 2012. He's been in the real estate industry here for over 17 years, and Invitation Homes is now one of the biggest single-family homes for rent operators in the nation with over 80,000 homes in 17 markets. Dallas, please say hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. No, I can't wait. So why don't we start off with just a brief kind of intro. Give us the story behind Invitation Homes.
Yeah, we started the business in 2012. A few entrepreneurs and myself with obviously great sponsorship from our capital partner in Blackstone. And we quickly built what has become the largest single family rental REIT in the U.S. And we had roughly 50,000 homes. Through middle part of last year, a little over 50,000 homes. And we just completed a merger with Colony Starwood at the end of 2017. And this year has been a busy year as we've integrated those 32,000 plus homes into our portfolio today. So today we sit at roughly 80,000 homes across 17 cities, mostly Sunbelt markets, and with predominantly most of our revenue coming out of the West Coast and parts of Florida.
So you are, I mean, you're still looking everywhere. Would you, I mean, let's start it this way. What are kind of the key factors you are going to look at when you want to enter a market or increase in that market or even pull back in a given market? What are the kind of those critical factors you're going to look at?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And we spent a lot of time as we built the business thinking through what would be the right portfolio mix long term. And there's a number of different things as we were building the business that we took into consideration. So certainly you look at household formation statistics, a lot of things that you guys follow at Burns Consulting, right? We looked at kind of where's our employment to permit ratio is going to be the best. And when I say permits, meaning new housing stock coming into the market. And as we took a step back, it wasn't rocket science to know that we were going to see an outperformance in terms of growth out of Sunbelt markets and parts of the West Coast that were going to lead themselves to larger household formation, population growth, which we believed back in 2012 would mean, you know, higher wage earners, more job growth, things that were going to put the economy back on track. So as we looked at a lot of that data, and you got to go back to 2012, there were big imbalances between what we could buy properties for relative to replacement costs. I mean, back in 2012, we could buy homes at 50% discounts to replacement costs. You can't find those kind of discounts today, but you can still find meaningful opportunities to invest at a discount in parts of markets that are higher barrier to entry and more infill. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on what that means. If you look at our footprint today, we're in 17 of the fastest growing cities in the country. We're in markets like Phoenix, Las Vegas, Southern California, Seattle. And then in the Southeast, we're in all the meaningful markets that are showing the most amount of growth. You know, Orlando, South Florida, Charlotte, Nashville, Atlanta. All these markets have lent themselves to greater performance from household formation. It's funny, Invitation Homes household formation is 90% greater than the U.S. average if you look on a go-forward basis in terms of expectations. So when you ask me the question, you know, what do we look for in a market? It's all those things I just described. We're looking for alpha or for that growth that will offer meaningful returns to our investors.
Oh, you still, so growth is critical. How about you mentioned discounts though, and back in the heyday of the single family rentals, right, where you were scooping up all those discounted homes at those tremendous values. And you mentioned though you still can find that somewhere, or is that still a key variable, or has it matured since then?
Yeah, it's a fair question. We look at replacement costs all the time, and we're looking for, you know, where are we seeing rising, you know, wage and labor costs? Where are we seeing cost of goods sold, meaning construction costs? Where are we seeing some of those being impacted the most? It's certainly happened in lumber and steel and some of these things that are going on in the current environment, right? Given kind of tariff regulation and some of the geopolitical stuff going on. But, you know, most importantly, you know, 4% unemployment around the U.S., that just means that generally speaking, you know, labor costs are going up, right? It's a premium workforce. And so specifically in markets that are showing an outperformance in terms of household formation, that cost to build a new product or a new home is expensive. More importantly, if you look at our footprint as a business, we're higher barrier to entry and we're much more infill. We're not out in the peripheries buying, you know, submarkets and communities where you've got a lot of greenfield around you. We're buying, you know, in parts of markets that are very dense. So if you think about a market like Phoenix, Arizona, you know, we're inside the 202 and the 101 freeways, and we're really focused on areas that are near desirability factors such as schools and transportation corridors. You're not going to find new product 9 times out of 10 in these types of environments. What you might find is that if you, you know, if you use the example of a home maybe getting scraped or heaven forbid an accident or a home burned down, a finished lot cost in that part of a market is quite expensive. And so for us, we still buy homes today at meaningful discounts to what it would be to replace in those same markets.
So you're looking for growth and high barriers to entry simultaneously.
Yeah, and really we you know, we tell the street this, we're total return investors. We're looking for a balance of yield, which would be that revenue stream and where we think we're going to have the greatest revenue growth, which is also a, you know, a fundamental of home price appreciation. And then we're also looking for that, for that asset appreciation. The beautiful part about single family is that in the single family space, each home is a liquid asset at the end of the day. We can buy and sell on the margin quite efficiently and continue to refine and optimize our portfolio.
So you're constantly sort of juggling, you know, what, how big we should be. Should we sell some here? Should we buy some there? Is that just such a constant ongoing strategy?
Yeah. In order to be a good capital allocator, we sit back and look at our portfolio on a day-to-day, week-by-week, month-by-month basis. And we look for areas where perhaps we're seeing underperformance. And that could be from an operational issue, or maybe there's a municipal issue that's causing us challenges. Fixed costs being too expensive, maybe an HOA, maybe we're seeing a property tax increase that, you know, is just happening faster than the norm. We'll also look at asset appreciation. So, you know, if you look at a lot of our West Coast assets, for example, we may see that, you know, in California, we might find a home that we bought, you know, for $500,000 5 years ago that's worth $1 million today, and it just doesn't pencil as a rental product anymore.
We should sell that
home back into the end user market. And it's a very efficient way for us to continually refine and optimize our business.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you're looking at just a ton of variables. How about demographics? Do you look at the demographics, the demographic makeup of a market when you, again, decide to go in, not go in, expand, retract?
Absolutely. And you're right. I mean, we're data junkies, and we've got a whole team that focuses on optimizing data and thinking through, you know, where is the greatest predictability for us in terms of that revenue stream and that revenue growth? Where are we going to see the biggest demand for our product? And that certainly brings those demographic factors into consideration. So, you know, a couple of things. As we take a step back, you know, in our business, our average customer today is about 39 years old. They've got about a combined household income of somewhere right around $100,000. And so that millennial cohort, we get a lot of questions around that. There's 65 million people between the ages of 20 and 35 that are coming our way in terms of our current customer base. And so we are looking at things like job growth and what types of markets are acquiring that level of talent, right? That age cohort. Are we seeing MSAs that are outperforming? Dallas would be a great example of that. The Dallas market is a great job market for people coming out of business school that are looking to make that first move or that second move into a more professional environment. And you see it in the fundamentals of the greater DFW area. You see it in the household formation statistics. You see it in the net migration statistics of what's happening in North Dallas and the Fort Worth area. And you also see it in some of the subjective information out there in terms of new businesses putting national and global headquarters in and around Dallas. Those are all things we look at that are driving additional talent to the area. We think it's meaningful.
How many U-Haul trips are going in and out of that metro area?
Transportation times are a big one, right? In terms of what it takes for somebody to get to, you know, the major transportation corridors. So you start to look at, you know, Seattle just overwhelmingly passed a bond that's going to create above rail, right? And it's going to take a long time for it to build, but they passed billions and billions of dollars their state did in terms of voting for it. And we look at that as a positive. It's just going to spur a tremendous amount of additional growth to areas like that when you make it easier for people to get, you know, downtown.
Hopefully it'll be a lot faster than here in California getting our speed rail across the state, which is yet to happen. You know, I want to just highlight that one stat you said, because I think every time I know that stat now, I've heard it multiple times, but that $100,000 is the average income for one of your customers. I think that shocks a lot of folks. Tell us about your customers. What is the makeup of your folks who are renting your homes?
Yeah, we don't know everything about our customers, right? We only know bits and pieces from our screening and our underwriting and some of the surveys we do. But as we've surveyed and we've talked to customers, we know that typically it's a joint household formation, 1 to 2 kids. Yeah. Generally, they have pets and they're really, truly looking for the leasing lifestyle. You know, today, our current customer is staying with us almost 3 years in our business. And that continues to grow quarter over quarter. And so we know we have a sticky profile there in terms of people that are choosing our type of living. What we have found is that they also want a suite of services. They want to find things. They want to optimize their home. They like the idea upon moving in of maybe having some optionality in terms of upgrades to flooring, kitchen upgrades, or even paint. And these are services that we're starting to provide. It's interesting if you think about it. You know, 20 years ago, people thought about leasing a car and it was like a bad word, right? Everybody yeah. wanted to own a car. Today, nobody cares. People love to lease vehicles and they love to switch it up every 3 to 4 years or whatever it is they choose. But they love the fact that in their lease, they can optimize. It's no different in housing. In our business, the way we approach it is that it should be no different. Someone should have a sense of ownership, whether they're leasing or whether they're owning a home. And as we refine that process for people moving in and we offer those services, we're finding that people are not only opting in, but they're choosing to do more to our homes. We love that because we start the assets long-term that way at less cost to us as a business.
That's interesting. There's always the skin in the game thing for ownership and why there's that pride of ownership. In your case, the skin in the game is the fact that they've spent some money options and upgrading and that they're going to be there for a fair amount of time.
Yeah. And people don't really appreciate when you buy a home. We've all been through this for those of us that have owned. There's more that goes on to maintenance in a home than you ever anticipate the first time you buy. And what's nice is we take all the, you know, the headache out of that from a management standpoint. We cover all the ends. We just expect a good customer that, you know, is a good citizen, a good neighbor. And on top of that, that we offer a service that they want to renew. We're finding that 70% of the time they renew their lease.
That's awesome. Let's talk about the industry for a minute. The single family space has been kind of dominated by the mom and pops kind of, right? The very small operators for the most part. Do you see that kind of gradually changing? Do you think we have some consolidation in the SFR space coming forward?
Well, there certainly has been some to date. I mean, we've had a number of consolidation moments. We just went through a merger with Colony Starwood, for example. Yeah. Earlier last year, Tricon bought Silver Bay. You know, Starwood and Colony had done a merger before that. Those were all big names in the space in a relatively new time frame, right? I mean, the industry's only been around 7 or 8 years from an institutional standpoint. It's been around forever in terms of people leasing homes for hundreds of years. There's going to be more consolidation for a couple of reasons. One, there are certainly good operators out there that are building up portfolios of substance. And at a certain point, every capital stack out there has to make a decision about whether they want to, you know, stay private, go public, or are we better off selling or merging our portfolio into a bigger company? And so those create moments of opportunity. The second point is we're seeing a lot of new capital come into the space. We hear almost weekly or monthly at a minimum, but typically weekly, we're hearing about a new investor, you know, a foreign sovereign or a pension fund that seems to be coming in and starting to build a portfolio in a couple of key markets. I think people have found, rightfully so, that this business of, you know, 16 million people that have rented homes for a long time parts of it should be institutional. And today, you know, maybe 250,000 homes are institutionally held out of 16 million. That's a really small percentage. It's less than 2 million. And, you know, why wouldn't this be an industry someday that 1 million or 2 million of the 16 million rentals are institutionally and professionally managed? Because people want that. They want all the bells and whistles that come with professional management.
Yeah, that's another amazing stat, by the way. That the portion of the single family rental market, when we understand how big it is and how it has been around for decades and decades in the U.S., it's the institutional share of that is absolutely tiny.
So it does make sense.
You're absolutely right. So tiny.
And so, well, one of the big hurdles, historically anyway, at least, one of the concerns of folks is that the operating expenses for a single family rental, at least compared to traditional apartment world, it's a higher operating expense percentage wise. How do you deal with that? How do you get around that or handle that?
Well, there's a couple of things that go into that, right? I mean, one of the things you got to appreciate about single family rental is about half of our expenses are due to property taxes, right?
Yeah.
And that's a different percentage than the multifamily business. So in markets that are growing, we're always going to have a bit of property tax growth, and there's nothing you can do about that. We're the largest payer of you know, property taxes and school taxes in the country as a business. And so, you know, it's something we quite frankly take some pride in. The cost of ownership, and I think it's because it's early, and I think you're referencing cost to maintain. You know, we've been pretty consistent around, you know, kind of in the high 2000s in terms of what it costs us to maintain a home year over year. But it is certainly early, and you know, vintage and age and quite frankly, geography come into play there. You know, in warm weather markets, it's a lot cheaper to maintain homes, generally speaking. And as you get into some of the wetter markets, you deal with things like roofs and vegetation, but it's all part of your original underwriting. And I think for the most part, you know, those that are in the public spectrum, like ourselves and some of our other peers, we've done a nice job of laying out what those costs are. And we've been pretty consistent year over year. So I think it's just that the industry is so new, people still have questions. There's less predictability. Yeah. Multifamily's been around for 30 plus years.
Yeah, that's fair. So essentially, that cost, that maintenance cost, whatever it is, that's been factored in now, and we have years of experience to see that you're still making money despite that. Is that fair to say, to characterize?
Absolutely, and the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, for professional managers like ourselves, we can maintain a home at a much cheaper cost than a traditional homeowner can, due to our procurement capabilities. I mean, if you think about it, you know, we buy materials by the truckload and the trainload, right? And there's efficiencies. Yeah. And then our cost of labor can be optimized over a long period of time. So we really do offer a much affordable approach to maintaining a home than what it would cost anyone that owns a home today.
Okay, that's a fair point. How about going forward? Now, let's do a couple of go forwards there to end our podcast here. The first one is, just what do you see as the biggest hurdle in general to the single family rental world going forward? What's your biggest worry when you wake up in the morning?
You know, I think we have a committed focus to making sure that we get the service side of the business really right. I believe that we are early stages in terms of what we can offer customers. There's so much low-hanging fruit in front of us as a business in terms of what we can and can't do in terms of what we offer the customer. So that's, I hate to use the word hurdle because it's more of an opportunity, but you can only do so many things so quickly as you're stabilizing these businesses and getting them running the way they are. Again, we're like in the first couple innings of this from an institutional standpoint, right? I think, you know, regulation's one that we're always sensitive to, making sure that we're working with states and municipalities, that the proper narrative is out there and the correct narrative. To your point earlier, we are such a small part of the housing continuum today. I mean, to be only 250,000 units institutionally managed, and we get a lot of headlines, for right or wrong, that can sway public opinion on things. And so we really want to be careful and make sure that our service and our product is consistent, and also that we work with municipalities to be an affordable housing option for people. That's really important to us.
Do you get kind of the for lack of a better term, I know it's a loaded term, but the NIMBY kind of reaction specific to you, specific, like they're afraid, oh, you're putting the mom and pops out of business, or you're taking out of the home ownership stock available to them? Do you get those kinds of reactions in given markets or neighborhoods?
Well, you get headlines once in a while. We also get really positive headlines, in fairness. I mean, we get a lot of, you know, reporters and news outlets that write really good reviews when they take the time to understand how the business works. But yeah, those are challenges. I think the other challenges for our space is, because it's so early stage, the tools are rapidly evolving. You know, multifamily, for example, has had 30, 40 years of revenue management systems and property management tools and asset management, you know, softwares that have continued to be developed. It's still the first inning in terms of single family systems and accounting softwares and you know, leasing tools and smart home technologies and things that we can implement into our property. So those are definite opportunities, but they're also hurdles early stage because there aren't a million customers out there that have institutional accounting platforms needed for single family rental. Now, we've done a nice job and we have great partners that have helped us build these out, but you'd love to see that part of the industry continue to develop a bit more.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned affordable, you're often an affordable option. Do you see that becoming maybe even, you know, all these cities have affordable goals they have to meet. Do you see SFR becoming a part of that solution potentially?
Well, it already is. You have a number of, you know, Section 8 customers across all the different portfolios out there to date. And so you definitely have some government subsidy in people's portfolios that you see out there. I would think that we can be a real big help on the community side long-term. There's a lot of ways to be involved and to help and to create awareness around some of the affordable options that are available to people. And the nice thing about it is people can choose to be down payment light. So if part of, you know, affordability is that we're looking for ways to get families into desirable neighborhoods that can otherwise not have to put down a huge down payment, that's a big deal because at a minimum, people are putting down 3%. Most people are putting down somewhere between 5 and 15%. And on a, you know, $300,000 home, that's a lot of money. It's anywhere from $15,000 to $45,000. With companies like us, if people don't have that down payment, but they've got, you know, fairly decent credit, they can move into a neighborhood and experience all those same things a homeowner can and can quite frankly stay as long as they like. And so we know there's an affordability factor here because of the amount of renewals we get in a year-over-year basis that people love the product, they like the neighborhood. So I think awareness of that is a good thing.
That's a great point. That down payment is such a hurdle, especially in those upper end price markets, that could be a yeah, that could be a big part of it right there. Let me last ask you, Dallas, one last question. It's just a little more general, and I'm going to, with a little specific cue at the beginning, is just long-term, what's your strategy going forward as much as you can divulge with us? And especially interested in, do you see kind of more partnerships with single family home builders in your future?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one we get all the time in the investor community. I would say, and I always say this to people, because we're going to continue to grow. We're a business that's focused on finding growth, both in our own portfolio today. From an organic standpoint, we see a lot of optimizing and a lot of low-hanging fruit that we can continue to evolve over the next couple of years with. And then outside of that, we'll externally grow when the opportunities are there and when things make sense. The specific question around would we buy new homes? The short answer is yes. We are channel agnostic, meaning we will look at every channel, and we do this today, in terms of where we can buy new product and add it to our existing footprints. But we are absolutely location specific, meaning we care about being in the right parts of the MSA, the right parts of the neighborhood where we think desirability is the greatest. And what we found is that will probably be a small part of our strategy going forward, but you're just not going to get a lot of new builder product in the most infill interior areas. And that's been a focus for us, is we like higher barrier to entry, a little bit higher price point where you've got little bit of a more sophisticated, not sophisticated, but a little bit of a higher price point where the desirability and probably the predictability of our customer is going to stay a bit longer. And so
that makes
for us, we'll infill opportunities like that from time to time. We've done a little bit of it, but I don't think it's like we're a home builder or we're going to start a home builder company. We'd probably be more likely to partner with home builders and find opportunities to buy from them over the long haul.
Yeah. We're hearing about that where, you know, it makes sense. We have a mix of renters and homeowners in a given new development. And when folks hear that, you know, your typical renter has that 100K income, I think that eases a lot of those concerns.
Exactly. We want to find that balance. And we want somebody who will stay with us for a long time, but also is willing to pay for the right type of product because it's a long-term decision for them. And so for us, If we're out in the greenfield areas where there's a lot of development still to come and things like that, it's going to take 5 or 10 years for those types of areas to mature. We want to be in mature neighborhoods where the desirability is already quite high.
Awesome. Anything else? Anything else you want to add or have a look forward kind of strategy?
No, I mean, I think if anything, we really appreciate people like Burns, John Burns, and the consulting team that you guys have put together. There's so much interesting data out there. And the more we can learn about what the customer is actually looking for, the better we can be at providing those opportunities. So we appreciate the opportunity to get our message out there, and we really appreciate the support from you guys and your team long term.
Well, we appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing your thoughts with us. Dallas, thank you very, very much.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much. And that's it for us here. Please give us a listen in a couple of weeks here. We'll have another episode for you. Until then, see you later.